The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, 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 all persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court.
Good morning. Well, Mr. Milling, you may proceed.
Sir, Your Honor. Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Milling, and I'm proud to be here today before you representing Tecoa Glover. In our efforts to vindicate a Sixth Amendment violation of his right to counsel, not once, not twice, but three times in this case, and you may think three times we've only got two different issues on appeal, but really his violation of his right to counsel started as soon as he was arrested, when his family chose to retain counsel out of Atlanta, Mr. Weintraub. And shortly after he received funds to retain his services, deposited those funds into a bank account, and chose to turn those over to the DEA. He chose to write a check, and the DEA kept those funds, thereby depriving Mr. Glover of the ability to secure counsel of his choosing. Before Mr. Glover even got to district court, before he was appointed counsel, he began to start requesting the return of those funds. He invoked his right to counsel of his choosing under the Sixth Amendment, under Lewis versus United States, to be able to have access to those funds, to be able to hire counsel of his choosing. He was never, not then, not a month later, but he was never given the opportunity to present facts to the district court to be able to show why he should be allowed to get those funds back to hire counsel of his choosing. These were funds that came directly from the lawyer's bank account. There was no authority for the DEA to be able to seize those funds or maintain those funds, and the government, even in their responses to the district court and the responses to the motions for the return of the funds, acknowledged that they could not have seized these funds in the first instance. If we look at the forfeiture statutes, there was no authority that was granted to the DEA, to the government, to be able to seize these funds or maintain these funds. And frankly, they should have been returned, but there was not an opportunity that was given to Mr. Glover to be able to do that. He was deprived of his right to counsel of his choosing, a structural error which pervaded the entire process here with the district court. He screamed at
counsel. Counsel, if I assume that is correct right now, that was improper, does the Sixth Amendment issues that exist pre-plea, how does our Moussaoui case not constitute an event that, you know, intervenes from a causation standpoint and constitutes a waiver of those issues? I understand your arguments and have some substantive aspects, but how does Moussaoui not block that argument for pre-plea issues?
Your Honor, I would just submit that because the structural problem here with the Sixth Amendment really pervades the relationship that Mr. Glover had with his two appointed counsel, and during the most of the process, Mr. Ailes, he did not have that guiding hand that the Sixth Amendment guarantees. He did not have confidence in the process. He did not have the ability to really work with a lawyer throughout the process. And so,
okay, Mr. Milling, Mr. Milling, one second. You know, as in preparing for this case, I'm very sympathetic to your argument, but what I'm really having trouble with is what Judge Quattlebaum has alluded to, because in Moussaoui, we rejected the premise that this was a structural error. We said specifically that we did not agree with the Ninth Circuit in Hernandez, and we said that it was a faulty premise. because it fails to account for the fact that if the defendant proceeded to trial and was convicted, he could seek an appellate remedy for the constitutional violation. So I'm worried because I think you make a really good point, but I'm really worried that Massawi boxes us in. It says the structural error analysis is a faulty premise. So how do we deal with that?
Your Honor, I think that we would have to look to other cases and look to the individual facts of this particular case, because since my client tried from the beginning, from the outset, to have this opportunity, he tried in earnest at every step of the way to really be able to bring this to a head and have a decision. I think the fact that we don't even have a hearing really gets us back to where a lot of the error is. He had no opportunity to be able to enunciate to the district court why that the issue was there, why he was having a problem.
I agree with you completely. I agree with you totally. I'm just worried that maybe we have to go in bank here in order to deal with the Massawi rejection of structural error. That's just what I'm wondering.
Yes, Your Honor, and that may be ultimately where we end up in this case, to be able to truly vindicate Mr. Glover's rights. Because as we look at Lewis, as we look at Boya Gomez, frankly, as we look at Farmer, you know, we've got a situation where there is no evidence in the record showing that these were tainted assets. The only evidence that we've got is Mr. Glover's representation that these were not tainted assets. And so not having a hearing deprived a full evidentiary opportunity to determine exactly what happened here. And it gets us to not just the Sixth Amendment, but as Farmer outlined, it was a due process violation. And so, you know, he did not have that opportunity. And the timing of it also really gets into play because, you know, if you don't have a lawyer from the get-go that you're working with to give you that counsel, to give you that guidance, you really lose the opportunity to know what's going on. You lose the opportunity under the Sixth Amendment to have that guidance of a lawyer. And that's really where the problem arises here. And it doesn't just arise from the outset, from the totality of the case, but we see it really at the end when he moves to withdraw the plea within a month of having to plead guilty. He was given a choice. You plead guilty under these circumstances, or we're going to trial, and we'll have the hearing after that.
The judge and the judge. Mr. Milling, I'm glad I wanted to ask you a question about that part of the a part of your case.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask it this way. I think, you know, if you look at the record, you know, the district court decides the motions that were heard in October of 19, and he really kind of, aside from some preliminary issues, talks about motion for substituted counsel and motion to withdraw, and doesn't, you know, in a discreet way address the conflict-free counsel issue. Now, we could question whether that was framed that discreetly, but regardless, that's not separated as an analysis. He talks about the coercion really in the more, you know, discussion. But here's my question. Does the district court, if presented with allegations that, if true, would create a conflict, does the district court have the ability to look at the record as a whole and say that those allegations are not credible based on the record as a whole? Is that within the district court's authority?
Your Honor, I think while the district court may have some authority to look at the totality of the circumstances, the record as a whole, and the framework that got us from point A to point B, I think it's incumbent upon the district court, upon those allegations being raised, to make sure that the client, that the defendant has a lawyer to advocate on his behalf to present those facts. We've got a situation.
So if I could just interrupt, I apologize for that. So I think I understand what you're saying, if the allegations, if true, are credible, you think at that point, hard stop, you get a new lawyer. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Even if that lawyer is limited to representing the individual during that particular proceeding, the allegations in this case were very pointed against Mr. Ailey's, his trial counsel. And at a minimum, we needed a lawyer to be able to step in to ask questions of Mr. Ailey's, put him under oath like we would in a normal 2255 situation.
So a district court then can't do what happened here, admittedly, maybe under Moore, but assume that he had said, now let's talk about conflict-free counsel. I want to take evidence, and based on what I've heard and based on your client's, quite frankly, history of less than forthright representations, I find that the allegations are not credible. The district court can't do that without appointing a separate lawyer. Is that your position?
That's my position, Your Honor, because Mr. Glover didn't have somebody to advocate on his behalf. He did not have anybody representing his interests. And as the First Circuit has found, you know, this is a situation where it is an essential part of the process to which he is entitled to counsel. He needed somebody to be able to represent him in the motion to withdraw the plea. And he didn't have that. He made it very clear with the district court, I don't want to represent myself. I want a lawyer to represent me in this proceeding. If he had said, I'm going to represent myself, then a Faretta warning would have been required. It wasn't given. But instead, he was left in this never-never land where he's got a lawyer against whom he's made allegations, who is given the opportunity to either fall on the sword and say, yes, this happened. I wasn't ready for trial. I wasn't ready for any motion hearings. I hadn't subpoenaed any witnesses. I don't have any evidence, any experts on cell phone triangulation or canine experts. I haven't talked to any impeachment witnesses. But instead, he says, I didn't endorse this motion. I don't think it's in his best interest. I don't see how that can be any further from advocating on behalf of your client. He chose self-preservation over representation of the client, and that's really where the conflict arises, and that's why Mr. Glover was left without counsel. He had nobody representing his interest, and so that's where really that second issue of the denial of the right to counsel comes into play here. He did not have anybody advocating on his behalf, anybody to talk through the Moore factors, anybody to really get into the sum and substance of these issues.
Okay, so what you're saying then, Mr. Milling, is that if we're forced to reject your argument that there was a structural error because of Massawi, we could nevertheless reverse on the basis that he was denied counsel?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I see that I'm out of time. I've got, I think, 7 minutes reserved for rebuttal, and I'll be happy to answer any other questions at that time. Thank you,
Mr. Milling. Mr. Gant.
May it please the court, my name is Addison Gant, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. This court should affirm the district court for two reasons. One, because regardless of whether Glover waived his right to contest the administrative forfeiture process, the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction to consider his claim. And two, with regard to his allegations of coercion, the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding his assertions of coercion lacked credibility. Briefly into some of the facts, the government and Glover agree that the funds were turned over to the DEA out of a concern for the source of their funds, and that's on JA 35 and 40.
Counsel, you said they were turned over due to a concern?
A concern for the source of their funds. That's the language.
Weren't those funds escrow funds?
Those were funds
were they escrowed funds?
Your Honor, the record isn't clear on that.
Wouldn't they have to be? if counsel received funds from a client, he or she couldn't just put it in a personal, right? Wouldn't it have to be escrow account?
Yes, Your Honor. I would assume that they were escrow funds.
So the counsel gave you escrow funds and you took them and you knew that they were escrowed funds.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that appropriate for the government to do that?
If there's nothing that prevents the government from going after funds paid to an attorney, if the attorney has reason to believe that those funds were legal funds, a reasonable basis to believe that they were illegal.
You didn't go after them, though. You didn't. He turned them over. That's based on your investigation. You made no real findings of forfeiture or seizure, did you?
Your Honor, that's because they were voluntarily turned over. And then the DEA...
They can't be voluntarily turned over if they don't belong to the person they're turned over. They're escrow funds.
Your Honor, it's no different than if somebody else finds money or is given money that is illegal and then turns that over, because under the forfeiture statutes in 881, the property interest in those funds vests in the government the moment the crime is committed. So those funds technically could not have been paid to the attorney in the first place.
But what you have now are funds turned over to their lawyer. You're talking about finding funds that are, you had no findings done as to whether or not this was elements or the product of any kind of, you just took funds that were escrowed from the client.
After we were informed by the attorney that they were drug proceeds.
Well, the attorney didn't know that. The attorney was concerned about the source of the money, but let me finish my question, if you wouldn't mind.
Yes, ma'am.
Just because you have a question about the source of the money as a lawyer, I mean, I had that happen to me when I was representing people. You don't go turn the money over to the police because you don't know. I mean, sure, sometimes you suspect that, but how does the lawyer have the right to turn over something that's not his to the police when he doesn't know?
He may suspect. Your Honor, on JA-35, Glover says that his attorney turned them over because they were drug proceeds. The government uses the language concern for the source, but Glover uses the language that his attorney told him they were turned over
Glover
because they were drug proceeds.
Speaking in the dialogue, but I think that Mr. Weintraub, was that his name?
That's the Atlanta attorney, yes, Your Honor.
He was clearly concerned that, you know, how did this man have this much money? What was the source of it? But how do you get to the point where he has a right to turn that over to the police?
Your Honor, as long as the attorney believes that they are drug proceeds, there's nothing that stops him from turning over. It may not be the approach that most attorneys would take, but it's the approach that this attorney took. The other
You're saying
problem
the money
Glover
wasn't
claimed.
Given to him in trust by the client?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't given to him by the client. Glover says the money was paid by family and friends, not by himself.
Right, exactly. On his behalf in trust?
Yes, Your Honor. The problem with Glover's claim, the main problem is that Glover never filed a timely claim with the DEA to contest the administrative forfeiture. If he had done so, it would have kicked the process over to the district court, and he could have had a hearing on whether the funds were tainted or untainted, or whether the attorney had or could have turned the funds over.
Okay, Mr. Gann, let me ask you a question. And, you know, this is just a practical question rather than, you know, your ultimate legal arguments. I mean, Mr. Glover clearly wanted the money to hire a lawyer. He kept asking the judge, and the judge said, well, that's civil or that's whatever. And Mr. Glover, though, maintained his position consistently. I want a lawyer. I've got the money to hire a lawyer. And the judge kind of blew him off, didn't he?
He did, Your Honor, but that's because the judge didn't have subject matter jurisdiction, and he couldn't have that jurisdiction until Glover filed a claim.
Did he ever explain that to Mr. Glover, why he was just ignoring it?
There is a moment in one of the hearings where the court says, to my knowledge, there's a claim that you can file for that. And Glover acknowledges in his pro se pleadings that the DEA provided him with notice about forfeiture. And Glover himself says that he told his friends and family not to file a claim because they were going to be charged with money laundering. So the The problem with all of his claims with the district court, even if you assume that filing that with the district court was enough to put the district court on notice that he wanted to contest it, none of those filings would amount to a claim to contest the forfeiture because he doesn't say that the funds were his. In order to contest administrative forfeiture, you have to file a sworn statement that the funds are yours and that you're intending to claim them. Then the process kicks to the district court. But if that claim is never filed, 18 U.S.C. 983 makes clear that the only motion you can file is a motion challenging the DEA's notice and whether that was sufficient. As long as he received sufficient notice that the DEA had his funds and was going to forfeit those funds if he didn't file a claim, then Glover received sufficient due process to challenge it. He just didn't choose that route.
Mr. Gant, you just raised a point I wanted to ask you about, which is the issue of whether they were his funds or not. Seems clear these funds were, you know, given to the lawyer in Atlanta, you know, on his behalf. But is it significant for a farmer-related claim that he doesn't claim they're his funds? Does that matter under the law?
That would matter under Farmer because Farmer itself was about judicial forfeiture after a person filed a claim for funds. You can't get subject matter jurisdiction to have a Farmer hearing in the first place if you never file a claim.
But aside from the not filing the claim from a procedural standpoint, I'm asking the question about whether Farmer, you have to assert they're your funds as opposed to funds on your behalf. Can you help me on whether that matters under the law?
Your Honor, the way I read Farmer is it takes the same approach that the Supreme Court took in Lewis, where the only question is whether the funds are tainted or untainted. If they're untainted and the funds are necessary to retain counsel, then they can't be restrained. Then they can't be restrained. But if they're tainted, or if a person forfeits their right to those funds by not filing a claim with the DEA, then they never get to the Farmer hearing. And Your Honor, with regard to subject matter jurisdiction, this court made clear in Ibarra in 97 that once the administrative forfeiture process begins, the district court is divested of subject matter jurisdiction and it remains without jurisdiction until a claim is filed. The Seventh Circuit has held the same thing in Mohammed in 06. There was a different case, though, where the AUSA misled the defendant into believing that filing a claim with the district court was sufficient to contest administrative forfeiture. That didn't happen in this case. The 11th Circuit held the same thing in Mesa Valderrama in 05, and that was a decision after CAFRA was enacted, and it held the same thing, that because of 983E, a district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction to hear any claim regarding administrative forfeiture once it's complete. Glover doesn't challenge that notice. He doesn't say it was deficient. He doesn't say he didn't have sufficient time. Instead, he goes straight to say that the funds were tainted or were not tainted. Administrative forfeiture isn't designed to decide whether funds are tainted or untainted. It's only designed to decide whether a person will claim funds. Glover didn't do that. His family and friends didn't do that. And the record makes clear that he told people not to file a claim. And Your Honors, I'm happy to explain more about administrative forfeiture, but if the court has no other questions in that regard, I'll move on to the second claim about coercion. A couple facts about his allegations of coercion that are pertinent to this case. First, Glover's case was associated with four different attorneys. The Atlanta attorney that we've discussed, who turned the money over to the DEA, a private attorney who made a limited appearance but wasn't retained, and two court-appointed attorneys. His first court-appointed attorney was removed a month into the case because the court wanted to accommodate Glover.
Counsel, can I interrupt you? I appreciate that background, but if you want to return to that, that's kind of, but we spent a good time reading that. So here's my question. First of all, do you concede that a motion to withdraw a guilty plea is an important enough part of the proceeding that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So then how do you deal with the issue your colleague raised? I mean, I get we have facts here that, you know, are unique based on some of the stuff you were, I think, going to talk about, the variety of counsels, the variety of issues. But yeah, how do we make sure that take it out of this case? Assume there, you know, is a actual conflict, and the client raises it. How do we make sure that the defendant is not left on his or her own to deal with a motion to withdraw? How do we make sure that doesn't happen? In ruling on this case,
Your Honor, I would say there's a two-step approach that the court could take. The first addresses whether the court adequately inquired into the conflict, the alleged conflict. If the court adequately inquired, and I know you said assume that there was a conflict, but there's a two-step process that I think applies. If the court adequately inquired into the process and found that the allegations lacked merit or weren't credible, then you can stop there. If you find that the court didn't make an adequate investigation, and then you can go and look at the facts alleged and assume that they're true, and then decide whether there's a conflict. If there was a conflict and the court didn't adequately address it, then that's an error and it needs to be addressed.
So where is that, counsel? I mean, that issue kind of relates to what I asked your colleague, which is, can the district court, in the face of allegations, look at the record and inquire into it and make a decision on that? And that sounds like that's part of your answer. Is there authority that you would point to on that issue?
Your Honor, I would point to a few things. First is this court's decision in Smith in 2011. The second is the Bachman decision. That's a 2000 opinion. And the third is it's a United States versus Craig. That's a 93 opinion. Ubachma and Craig both dealt with allegations of coercion or an involuntary plea. And in both instances, the court did not appoint substitute counsel, but instead was able to credit the Rule 11 colloquy to say that the post-plea assertions were not credible, and therefore the court didn't have to appoint counsel. If all the court can do is look at the hearing and the allegations, and then it's handcuffed into almost always having to provide replacement counsel, as long as the defendant files the right motion. If you take the motion that Glover filed and you tweak it a little bit to match your case, you're automatically entitled to a new attorney if the court isn't allowed to make credibility determinations. And this court is able to look at what the district court did and decide whether it adequately investigated. In this case, in the Craig opinion, that the court didn't even hear from the defendant. It only allowed counsel to address the issue and then said the sworn Rule 11 statement contradicts what you said, and your allegations that you were coerced or didn't plea voluntarily lack merit and lack credibility. And this court affirmed.
But Mr.
This
Gant,
court went even.
Mr. Gant,
yes, Your Honor.
In this case, isn't that totally different? The conflict was voiced right on the record when the counsel admitted, well, basically, in short, I know better than he does. I want him to do this. It was clear they were in conflict. Isn't that on the face of the record they were in conflict?
Your Honor, it's clear that Glover created a conflict. It's not clear that a conflict did exist.
He created one by not agreeing with his counsel. Is that your position?
A conflict did arise whenever he accused his counsel of coercing him into pleading guilty, but that does not mean that he actually coerced him into pleading guilty.
But didn't his counsel say on the record that I want him to do this?
The counsel said it's in his best interest, Your Honor. And then I believe he stopped
and
going further.
Let's use some common sense and look at the thing. Isn't it clear he was saying that I think it's in his best interest, but my client doesn't?
Your Honor, that could have been because he got a stipulated sentence to the mandatory minimum of 120 months.
A lawyer doesn't do, no matter how great the deal is, the lawyer can't decide that unilaterally.
That's correct. He can't decide that the plea agreement should be that he has to plead guilty.
If you tell the judge that basically right in front of the judge, I think this is the best for him, and he really doesn't know. Why is that not a conflict?
Your Honor, I think if you take it a step further, let's say that the court did appoint substitute counsel. And then if that substitute counsel investigated the claims and found that they weren't supported by anything, that counsel would be in the position of not arguing Glover's argument as well. And that would be against Glover. So it's possible that Glover's argument simply lacked merit at all.
it's possible that it lacked merit.
Yes, Your Honor, and the district court adequately inquired into the situation to find Glover's allegations.
That turns the Sixth Amendment on top of his head. How can it not be important and intrinsic to the client to determine whether or not they're going to give up all of these rights? No matter how good the deal is, what do you mean? He created the conflict. There was no merit to the conflict. There's always merit if I don't want to plead guilty.
I agree, Your Honor. I'm not saying that the attorney gets to decide that the plea should not be revoked, or that it is certainly up to the defendant to decide whether to plead. But it could also be that a defendant filed a motion simply because they didn't want to go to prison and they wanted to create a conflict and delay the inevitable. And that's what the court thought that Glover was doing. It looked at his prior conduct in filing, I think it was 40-something motions before the court, despite the fact that he was represented. It looked at the fact that he had tried to remove both of his court-appointed attorneys, one of them right before the plea, where he made accusations that clearly lacked merit and that were then refuted by the prison logs. And then the fact that his sworn Rule 11 statement stated explicitly that he was not coerced, that it was his decision to plead guilty because he was in fact guilty. Glover does not claim that he is innocent, and he does not contest anything other than the fact that he filed this motion saying that he was coerced. And the only question is whether the court adequately inquired. If it inquired, and this court believes that was adequate, the court isn't handcuffed into providing substitute counsel.
Now, okay, but Mr. Gant, if we find that the record is insufficient to show that the court adequately inquired, then you have a problem, don't you?
Your Honor, in that case, this court has two options. One, to remand for the limited purpose of the court to hold a hearing to inquire further or appoint substitute counsel and argue the coercion claim. Or two, deny it and say that it isn't appropriate on appeal and that it should be brought in a 2255, and then Glover can then have an evidentiary hearing. Your Honor, I think in this case, the court's approach was to look at the case as a whole, and the district court is in the best position to observe the relationship between the counsel and his attorney. I'm sorry, the counsel and his client, and that it was not an abuse of discretion for the court to say, based on your prior conduct and based on these allegations, I think they lack merit. Even if you get to if you find that the court abused its discretion, you can then look to see whether the claims themselves would arise to a coercion to make the plea involuntary. And in that case, I think this case is significantly different than the two First Circuit cases that Glover relies on. In Sanchez-Barreto, there were several allegations of coercion. The only one that the court remanded on was the one where the attorney walked into the hearing and attempted to withdraw, and that was a red flag that the court should have caught and should have then appointed substitute counsel and not made the attorney continue. The second one is Seguier-Rivera, that's an 07 opinion. That one, the client didn't speak English. He had a limited education. He was confronted with his wife in prison to convince him to plead guilty. He responded on cue. There was allegations that his attorney concealed evidence. Those allegations go significantly far more in depth than what Glover has alleged in this case.
Mr. Gant, wasn't there a motion scheduled the day after the plea?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure whether there was, but Glover does say that there was.
You don't know the record?
I do know the record, and I know that there were hearings coming up after the plea. I don't know exactly how far away they were.
Weren't these hearings to decide whether or not he was still trying to get the funds back?
The government, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I seem out of time. Can I answer?
Yeah, you may.
There was a potential farmer hearing at issue, but the court had not decided what it was going to do with that.
But it was pending the next day after the guilty plea.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction.
How could you have a legitimate Rule 11 proceeding for a guilty plea and you know the next day is scheduled to decide whether or not he can get the funds to get the lawyer that he wants? So if you ask questions like, well, are you pleased with your lawyer? Well, Your Honor, if you look on the docket, next day I got trying to get another lawyer. So the answer is, how could it be an answer that yes, even on this record? The next
Your Honor,
day,
I'll...
wait a minute. And you say you don't know the record, but it was the next day, wasn't it?
I believe that's correct, sir.
Yeah, that's why I asked you the first time. And it was the next day, you got a motion to decide whether or not I can get the money to have the lawyer that I need and want. But then that day you're pleading and your lawyer said, no, this is, I think this is best for him. How do you have a Rule 11 colloquy and say, I think they ask questions like, are you pleased with your lawyer, correct?
Your Honor,
are you satisfied with the work your lawyer's done, am I right?
Yes, Your Honor, that was the question, and he said yes, and it's very possible that Glover changed his mind and decided to take a sentence at the mandatory minimum.
It's very possible? And that is, it's very possible?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what he stated under oath, that he was pleading guilty because it was his voluntary decision.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Milling?
Thank you, Your Honor, and if I may just start off by responding to Mr. Gant's supposition that it's very possible that he changed his mind, and I would submit respectfully that it's very possible, and in fact, more likely, that my client saw the record for what it was, that he was not getting a hearing, he was not getting a new lawyer, he was given the opportunity to proceed pro se, or he was given the opportunity to proceed with Mr. Ailes, a lawyer against whom he had already tried to relieve his counsel, and Judge Kane had said, you are not getting another court-appointed lawyer. If we look at the record as a whole, going back to before he even arrived in district court, he was trying to hire a lawyer of his choosing. He was never given that opportunity. So Judge Gregory, to your point, he knew that he wasn't going to get what he wanted. He was simply trying to make the best out of the situation because he was given two bad choices at the time of the guilty plea. You're absolutely right. He had a hearing scheduled the next day, and frankly, he was given the choice. You either plead guilty or you go into trial, and you may or may not have to go to trial with Mr. Ailes, a lawyer against whom you've already tried to get relieved as counsel. We fast forward to the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, and unfortunately for Mr. Glover, the court starts off the proceeding on page 289 of the JA asking whether or not he's competent. If that doesn't telegraph to Mr. Glover where Judge Kane's mind is, I don't know what does. And then he goes forward to say, Glover is trying to set up an appeal or a 2255. There was no inquiry into the record as to the sum and substance of these allegations. And it is above beyond.
Mr. Milling, let me stop you there. I mean, you say there's no inquiry into the record. I understood your earlier position that really you don't have to have an inquiry, that if the allegations are such, you automatically get a new counsel. But, I mean, I can give you the cites. I mean, we could debate whether it's an adequate inquiry, but he asked Mr. Glover about his claim. Mr. Glover responded. He asked the assistant U.S. attorney. He asked the lawyer. And then he discusses the evidence or the responses he gets from everyone on the record. I mean, I grant you it was in the context of the Moore hearing and not discrete in the other issue. But, I mean, you know, it seems like he does address the substance of it actually relatively thoroughly. I mean, you know, so to me, this seems like the question is, does the district court have the right to go into that, or do the mere allegations trigger the right to a new counsel? You know, you say the latter, you know, your colleague says the former. Seems to me that is at least one important issue here.
I would agree, Your Honor, that that's a very important issue, and I stand by my position that once these allegations of a conflict arise, then he needs a lawyer to be able to represent him moving forward, like we would see in a 2255 hearing. But because Mr. Gant raised the issue of looking at the record, I wanted to make a quick point of being able to talk about some of the things in the record. Because when the district court turns to Mr. Ailes, that's when he says, I didn't endorse, nor did I file this. To Judge Gregory's point, the lawyer doesn't have the opportunity to make a choice of something as fundamental as this. It's the client's. The client is the only one who can choose to plead guilty or not. Likewise, is the client's decision.
So that's an interesting question. So, I mean, if the lawyer thinks, given the record, the evidence against the defendant, that filing a motion to withdraw is not in his best interest, are you saying he must go forward and argue for that?
I believe so, Your Honor. Okay. So, and I've had to do it representing clients in the district court where I have negotiated pleas on behalf of the client, where the client has chosen to accept those pleas, and thereafter the client comes forward and says, I want to move to withdraw my plea. And so what I as counsel did was go through and walk through the different more factors and address them as best I could on behalf of my client while trying to make sure that I was providing as zealous an advocation for my client as I could. It's not always easy, and I'll be the first to admit that, but that's not my decision whether or not to make that motion to move to withdraw the plea. Now, part of what lawyers are supposed to do is make sure that you've got a good enough relationship with your client that you can talk to them, that you can counsel them, that you can provide that guiding hand that our Supreme Court talks about and make sure that they understand what some of the potential consequences are, what the elements are, and inquire of the client, what do you submit we need to argue as it relates to representation of innocence, for example. Yes, sir.
But yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I think I understand your answer. I appreciate that.
And that's where the district court, knowing what it had to look at, if we even got to the more factors on a motion to withdrawal, should have asked questions of Mr. Glover, and Mr. Glover should have had a lawyer to be able to advocate on his behalf for some of these points under Moore, as to whether or not he was asserting his legal innocence, as to whether or not the plea was knowing and voluntary, and as has been presented here before. Looking at the record, it is clear that there was a conflict, that there was a problem, that there were challenges and difficulties between counsel and Mr. Glover. And while the district court surmises that was something that was created by Mr. Glover, it is the job of counsel to make sure that you are advocating on behalf of the client. There was no advocacy whatsoever at the critical stage of the motion to withdraw the plea. And that's where my client was denied his right to counsel.
Ms. Milling, what is determinative then? Is it the fact that the court didn't conduct an adequate inquiry, or the fact that counsel didn't advocate, or both? In other words, is one of those sufficient to require reversal in your view, or do we have to have both?
I think it's either. I don't think we have to have both, because there are responsibilities on both counsel and the district court. The district court has a responsibility to preserve the record, to make sure certain things are done. And frankly, what the district court should have done is hired counsel to be able to advocate, because the judge is supposed to be neutral. The judge is supposed to protect the record and make sure that the rights were preserved here. And that wasn't done. Even if there was a lawyer who was appointed to represent Mr. Glover at this hearing, if they had not advocated, let's say it's Mr. Ailey's best friend and he doesn't advocate on behalf, or he's appointed in the courtroom and he's not able to provide full presentation on the issue, the Sixth Amendment is violated there as well. And so I think that Judge Keenan, in either scenario, that we can give rise to a vacation of the judgment and a remand. And I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Milling.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And thank you, Mr. Gant. Mr. Milling, I note that you are court appointed. And
yes, sir.
I just want to say on behalf of the Fourth Circuit, we thank you so much. Counsel like yourself take these cases to help us, and we really appreciate it. And Mr. Gant, we acknowledge your able representation of the United States. We wish we could come down and shake hands as our normal tradition, but we cannot. But know nonetheless that we appreciate your being here and your fine arguments. Be safe and stay well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honors.